For our bill, right? There's like a ton of people.
On education for February 22nd, 2017. Okay, we're going to start out. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2550. Alethea, if you could introduce the measure, please.
Yeah, Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2550 directs education service districts to provide access to social worker services for programs that serve students with special needs, which include special education services and at-risk students. There is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hack.
I think there's a few others that might join me if that's okay.
Oh, okay.
Or do you want them to wait?
Because we had a panel of three. Do
okay.
Well,
you guys can wait.
Okay,
then.
Come on out.
Either way. Oh, she says come up.
Oh.
You're up.
She's the boss. She's the boss.
Yes.
Thank you.
This
is mine. Welcome. Chair Doherty and members of the committee, thank you for having me. State Representative Jody Hack. I represent South Salem, Almsville, and Turner, and I am here today representing House Bill 2550, and it has to do with social workers in schools. I think this is a critical issue if we are ever going to move the dial on absenteeism and graduation rates. We have done away with a lot of our family support services in schools, and we pulled counselors out. And then also began to require our counselors to do a whole lot more paperwork than actually working with kids and families. So I think there's a huge need for integrating counselors into our schools. The thing that's unique about my bill, and I'm going to actually not completely, I'm going to do a little research on why it's being referred to Ways and Means, because what I'm asking is that the local service plan dollars through the ESDs be used for social workers. So I'm not actually asking for any funds to be allocated. What I'm asking for is that the ESDs take those local service dollars that they're already provided and allocate some of those funds for social workers so that schools can utilize the social workers through their ESDs. Local service plan dollars oftentimes are used a lot of times they used to employ nurses, and to this day, I know they have folks that provide IT services and that kind of thing. If a school district is smaller or they don't want to employ someone full-time, they'll use their local service dollars and contract with the ESD to provide those types of services. Same sort of concept that I want to do in this bill is to say let's employ social workers and begin to get them into schools. Given our budget issues this session, I don't want to see that be a barrier to implementing social workers as soon as we can into our school systems. So I thought that this would be a great way to be able to do that sooner than later. Currently, my research indicates that there are only 36 social workers in our school systems in the state. We may have a little different information from you guys. I don't know. We'll see. Yeah.
School social workers.
School social workers. Sorry.
Yeah. Licensed social workers.
Yeah. So it's important that we take a look at this. I know there are some other bills, and Chair Doherty has been kind enough to schedule a meeting for all of us to sit down and kind of talk through how this might look in the future. And so I'd be more than happy to do that. But I just thank you, Chair, for allowing for the hearing today and for recognizing that this is an important issue. So I thank you for that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, if you want to.
Me?
Yes, and make sure you identify yourself for the record.
Okay. My name is Ellen Baltus, and I have been a social worker for 35 years. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and one of the few licensed school social workers in the state. I am one of the founding members and present treasurer of the Oregon School Social Work Association. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2550, and thank you for allowing me to speak. Knowledge of trauma-informed approaches, mental health expertise, and a social systems perspective when working with students, families, and school communities. These are some of the strengths trained and experienced social workers can bring to schools. These skills are what is needed more and more often in the day-to-day workings of a school setting. These needed skills are often missing in our Oregon schools, causing low graduation rates, high rates of absenteeism, and an increasing number of vulnerable students feeling lost and disengaged. According to an Education Week study, Oregon is allowing low-income students to fall further behind their better-off counterparts faster than 48 other states. Compared to 2003 and 2015, low-income fourth and eighth graders were 9 percentage points further behind than their more prosperous peers with school. Over 20 years ago, I made a decision to start working in schools after working in child welfare. Before working in schools, I was a caseworker, placing youth in and out of residential treatment centers. I realized that youth who had an easier time reengaging back into the community were those who had had early positive school experiences. Youth who saw schools as a safe place where they had had safe, supportive relationships that allowed them to feel successful and competent. I decided I could reach more children before problems began and have a greater impact in a school setting. Like me, many social workers that come into the schools have previous experience doing social work in our community. That experience is invaluable. I can think of, in my district alone, there are social workers that have worked in mental health, in hospitals, in juvenile justice, in child welfare, in day treatment, in drug and alcohol treatment centers. They bring those skills to the schools that help those kids and those families that are most vulnerable. That is different than other disciplines. The school where I work now is a Title I elementary school in Milwaukee, Oregon, where all students receive free and reduced lunch, and about 45% of the near 500 students' first language is Spanish, with many being newer immigrants to the United States. My school has 25% of its students on IEPs, many with an eligibility of emotional disturbance, and we have a self-contained classroom for behavior. My elementary school has one of the highest rates of students experiencing homelessness and has one of the highest rates of annual child abuse reporting in my school district. I am the only school social worker at my school. There is not a school counselor. There's a behavior specialist that works half-time that we use our Title I funds to help us with. I have 2 graduate interns to help me do my work. It still isn't enough. We know from the trauma research that children with a greater number of traumatic events are 2.5 times more likely to fail a grade, score lower on standardized tests, have more expressive or receptive language difficulties, are suspended or expelled more often, and are designated to special education more often. On a daily basis, I hear stories of trauma from children that involve violence, abuse, deportation, family incarceration, addiction, and multiple forms of loss. Because building relationships and trust is the core to our school's success and is a key resiliency factor in combating trauma, it means most of my staff are also hearing these stories. As a social worker, I knew that when a student came up to her teacher during math the other day saying they couldn't concentrate because their mom's boyfriend kept touching them last night, I knew I'd already trained that staff member on how to respond to a child reporting abuse. I also knew I had already taught sexual abuse prevention in the classroom, including how to tell an adult you trust. With my mental health experience and child welfare background, I knew how to emotionally support that staff member, that student, and family before, during, and after the reporting process. My trauma-informed training allowed me to understand how to get through these difficult times with the least amount of additional trauma to all involved. Many educational staff have not been trained on the impact of vicarious trauma and yet experience that daily at my school. Hearing these stories and responding to difficult behaviors can feel overwhelming. Much of my work as a school social worker involves using my clinical mental health skills to not only support the students, but to emotionally support the staff in managing trauma's impact on their own lives. I train all staff on the effects of trauma on student behavior and learning, how to effectively intervene without re-triggering a child, and how to develop personal plans to compassionately care for themselves while caring for others. These skills help prevent staff burnout and absenteeism, and they help them to stay engaged with some of the more difficult students they teach. We have a saying that sometimes the students that are the hardest to love are the ones that need love the most, and my staff is incredible in responding to them.
These are the necessary school social work services needed in school communities today, especially in Title I schools. As a social worker, I'm also trained at looking at how systems in and out of the school can support my school community and improve my students' success. I work with multiple partners in the community to relieve the stress of poverty on the family and the weight that can bear on a child's mind when they enter this building. I understand and connect with the ever-changing services available for families needing food, housing, medical, immigration services, low-income legal services, domestic violence services and shelters, long-term mental health resources, crisis intervention resources, drug and alcohol treatment supports, and low-income after-school programming options. My development of relationships with these community partners helps to make connections for my students and families easier. My social work lens and training helps me to do this naturally. I've always done it before and now coming to the school setting. To improve school achievement and school attendance, we can no longer look at the student in isolation from family, culture, and community. We must see and intervene on the why behind the absenteeism, the poor behavior, the low achievement. By being part of the school culture on a daily basis, which I am, families and students have come to trust me. They know me as Mrs. B, who takes the puppet in the classroom and who their kids like. That breaks down that barrier of trust that they often don't have because of their previous life experiences with other systems. This allows me to uncover what barrier a child may truly be experiencing that is interfering with their education. The why is usually some form of trauma that likely is complex and rooted in multiple systems and or mental health concerns. Social work training and expertise in trauma, mental health, and a systems perspective is ideal for understanding this. I am so thrilled to see the efforts made by legislatures to increase the role of social workers in schools. I know from my early work in child welfare and my present work in the schools, it is what works, especially for our most vulnerable students and families. Thank you so much for proposing this bill and the others I hope to come.
Okay, thank you very much.
Chair Doherty, I'm going to have to go back to committee. Does anyone have any questions for
me? Any questions for Rep. Hamm?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and the committee. My name is Dr. Julie Prindle. I am representing the Oregon School Social Work Association, Portland State University, and also Portland Public Schools. I currently am the Senior Manager of Social Work Services for multiple pathways to graduation in Portland Public Schools. I also teach at the university, and I teach social workers how to be social workers in schools. I currently work on supporting 9 social work students in various programs throughout alternative schools in Portland Public School to really meet the needs that aren't getting met. So they address the trauma work, the mental health work, and these are graduate students that we're putting into the schools to support that. And I also build trauma work in the schools and help the district figure out what trauma work will look like for our district in the coming years. I'm excited and I'm supportive of House Bill 2550 and creating more access to school social workers in Oregon and working to meet the immense needs of our students, families, and staff. Ellen, I think, said most of what I would have to say today, but I really want to reiterate that the work that we do is that we are really uniquely trained to address the systemic and social determinants that are getting in the way of our students finding success and graduating from school. That's poverty. That's equity issues. That's trauma, resiliency, learning and academic issues, family issues, mental health, addiction prevention and intervention, suicide prevention and intervention, immigration, cultural alliances. This also includes supporting the whole school and working with multi-tiered systems of support. Our social workers work at all levels of support, providing universal interventions, one-on-one counseling, group counseling. They're in the families. They're working with the families. They're doing home visits. For over 110 years, school social workers have been doing this work in this country, and they became the vital link at a time when our country was exploding with immigration, and there were barriers to language, there were barriers to the school understanding what home life was like and what was creating difficulty to access education and to attend school. Those are very similar to what's happening today and what I see happening in my school. We have children who come to school every day hungry. We have children who pack up their backpacks every weekend with bags with cans of food so that they can make it through the weekend.
These are the things that's at the heart of the social worker and that is much needed in our schools. The other day I was at an administrative meeting, and because we are having a deficit in our budget in the coming year, administrators were worried about what we would do. And traditionally they said, normally we cut off our arm. We cut off all the supports that have helped improve graduation rates, and our most vulnerable communities suffer. And so how can we move to a place of keeping social workers, adding social workers, adding those extra supports so that we don't destroy the movement that we're making, and our most vulnerable communities are not the ones who are being continually hurt. We fall under the specialized support personnel, like all the counseling and the school psychs. And what we're asking and we're hoping in Oregon is that we really move towards what other states are doing and having an interdisciplinary team that works well together that can meet the multiple needs in the school. Skip a few things that Ellen highlighted. I think also what I want to reiterate is that social workers really address the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and that none of our students can excel if some of them are not. And so we need to make sure that we're paying attention to those communities and school social workers. That's the heart of their work. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Dear Chair and members of the hearing committee, my name is Martha Calderon. I am a board member of the National Association of Social Workers and a Portland State University Master's in Social Work graduate. I come to you in support of House Bill 2550. As a regional representative for NASW, I speak and work alongside many wonderful and talented school social workers. Currently, my position is a licensed school social worker for the Lebanon Community School District, working with students, staff, and families at an elementary K through 5. As a school social worker, I have utilized education and past practices to inform perspectives, protocol, and interventions when I work with others. I am part of an interdisciplinary team, working closely with the principal, teachers, behavioral support, parents, school, nurse, special education teachers, and district staff, just to name a few. Within this team, my unique point of view provides a lens of micro to macro touch points of support for interventions. This lens may include student support, teacher adaptations, family systems acknowledgement, or interventions or a systems review, all of which inform the team about the unique strengths, struggles, and barriers each student brings to the educational table. As a social worker, Maslow's hierarchy of needs is ever present in supporting our students. It is a united push for all children to be prepared for academics. Although, if the body and brain have barriers to learning, then learning cannot exist. Our job includes food, resources, clothing supports, shelter assistance, and these basics are necessary building blocks for safety and security of our students. As a social worker, it is our commitment to ensure students' protection from dangerous situations or threat of physical or psychological harm. As a school social worker, it is our responsibility to support students' self-esteem and growth in respect for others. As a school social worker, it is our concern of each student's It is our concern of each student's knowledge, exploration, and understanding of the world through their cultural paradigm and that of others. And as a social worker, it is our strive to build love and belonging for all students and staff within our school community. This delivery is of service of truest understanding of trauma-informed care. And I just kind of want to divert a little bit and tell a little bit of a story. Recently, there was a tragedy last week at the Lebanon School District. I'm not sure if anybody heard the news of a domestic violence situation that costed someone's life. I am part of the crisis care team that responded to that And to be able to open up that floor and be able to provide support in a different dynamic for our students, staff, as well as for first responders, was very humbling. I do a lot of play therapy, and so I don't have pictures for everybody, but here is a picture of one of the police officers that was there. And just to be able to be of support even to him really, really allowed all of us to show what it is that we do as school social workers. Mm-hmm. It's beyond. And I'm very, very happy to be a school social worker. I worked really hard to be a school social worker, and I'm honored to hold that title. And I just thank you, everybody, for your opportunity to hear us. Thank you.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Are there any questions of the panel?
Okay, thank you very much. And one thing with this bill is that there are like five that are very, very almost identical. And so we are getting a committee together to go through and look at all the bills and see how similar they are. Okay, thank you. Now, those are the only three that we had signed up. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on House Bill 2550?
Okay, is it possible to make a comment?
Pardon?
Can I make a comment?
Oh, yes. Go ahead and make a comment.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to say thank you very much for being here today. You have described so much of where we are today. It's not just about reading, writing, arithmetic anymore. Absolutely, it's important to be in our schools and provide this support for our teachers and our staff members and our students and families. And so you touched on so many things about your lens and your experience and what you're bringing into the classroom. And building your relationship is utmost number one, and I just wanted to say thank you very much for taking the time to be here today.
Thank you for your time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, with that, we close the public hearing on House Bill 2550 and turn this over to Representative Wilson.
I'm going to move to 2651 next.
Yes.
Okay. Sounds good. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2651, and I believe Representative Doherty will be first to testify as soon as she picks up her testimony.
Okay.
And, Lethia, would you like to tell us about the bill, please?
Yeah. Vice Chair Wilson, members of the committee, House Bill 2651 includes school class size as the mandatory collective bargaining subject for school districts. There is a subsequent referral to the Business and Labor Committee.
Thank you. Representative Doherty.
Thank you very much. For the record, I'm Margaret Doherty. I'm the state representative for House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. And I'm here today to speak on the bill that actually should be in Business and Labor, but it is starting out in education. And what this is to recognize that class size should be what we refer to as a mandatory subject of bargaining. And in the public sector bargaining world, and also I guess just public sector, you have things called mandatory and permissive subjects of bargaining. A permissive means that you can bargain anything. It's usually wages, hours, and working conditions, and those are what the law has described as to what a permissive item is. But then they have a few things like mandatory, and actually if you read the law, and it's in the House bill that we have, some of the things that are considered permissive means you don't have to bargain it. But the mandatory subjects, they've got things like dress, appropriate dress, and that is in the statute. Or, you know, things like that. And one of the things they have listed as a permissive subject of bargaining that you cannot bargain is class size. And you're going to be hearing from a couple of people today about the reason why class size is not what they consider a mandatory subject of bargaining right now. And it goes back quite a bit. And so what this bill will do would include in the collective bargaining statute for public school teachers in Oregon class size, that you are able to sit down and do it and talk about class size. But the one thing I want to be very clear about this is that by having something as a mandatory subject of bargaining does not mean that you are going to, one, agree to it, or two, that it's going to be in the collective bargaining agreement. What it just means is basically you're going to be able to sit down and have conversations about it and talk about it. There are school districts that already talk about class size, and there are school districts that already have class size in their contract. When I was a teacher, we had class size in our contract, and we only would, for example, in language arts, we had 125 students a day. In social studies, there was 150, and kindergarten, there were 21 students. And so the district had that as a guideline for it. Currently, at least what I've been able to track down is both Medford and Central Point have class size in their contract. And they actually listed out, for example, in Central Point, kindergarten has 21 students, grade 1 has 23, grades 2 and 3 have 25, and grades 4 and 5 have 29. And so there are other school districts that do have class size, but I want to make it very important that by being able to have class size as a mandatory subject of bargaining, the sky is not going to fall and the world will not stop. The one thing that's going to be brought up is that there was a Supreme Court case that dealt with class size, and it went through and talked about class size, but it's 25 years old. And so I want to give a little comparison as to what life was like in 1991 when it was decided by the Supreme Court and was based on an Employment Relations Board thing, and what things are like now. So, for example, what they did at the ERB decision is that they basically went through and said that class size, the Supreme Court ruled that the Employment Relations Board, which uses all of the different balancing tests for class size, really hadn't done what they were supposed to do, and so class size should not be a mandatory subject of bargaining, that it really didn't affect a student's life. And that's a little bit of my words, but it's Tualatin Valley Bargaining Council versus the Tigard School District, which is also, you can see how it's kind of dated. We have not had bargaining councils for about 20 years, and it's now the Tigard-Tualatin School District because we built Tualatin High School. So that's where it's different. But I want to talk a little bit about what was like in 1991. Basically, in 1991, Measure 5 had barely kicked in, and so we didn't have that. But there were some other things in 1999 that shows that a balancing test, how things change. For example, in 1999, the average house in the United States was $142,000. Gas was $1.41. A stamp was 25 cents. A gallon of milk was $1.41. And I weighed 122 pounds. And as my legislative assistant pointed out, he was not born. We look at, for example, now 2016, and the average house in the United States is $379,800. Gas, the average was $2.49. A stamp is 49 cents. Milk is $3.98. Now, I will not tell you how much I weigh. So anyway, things have changed, and this is where I think it's so important that in collective bargaining, some of the things that we can bargain change also. The one thing I want to make it very clear, by having mandatory subject to bargaining and having class size in there, it does not mean that the local school district has to agree. It does not mean that the local school district will go belly up because all of a sudden they have all this class size and they have to lower all these grades and they have to have, you know, hire all these teachers. It has to be agreed on. It's the same sort of thing that you agree on during collective bargaining on wages, on hours, on working conditions, and lots of different working conditions. And so it doesn't mean that you're going to agree, but it does mean that you do, that management just can't say, we're not going to talk to you. We're not even going to discuss, and we're not even going to breach the subject. And so that's why it's so very important to have that in there. And as I said, the sky is not going to fall. I think you, like most bargaining and successful bargaining, as you sit there, and I mean, I've did this for 25 years, is that when you have issues that are extremely important to the teachers, which also kind of translate into what's important for kids, class size comes up, you know, over and over and over again. And so what we wanted to say, I want to reiterate, is it doesn't mean we're going to agree, and it just means that management does not have the ability to say, we are not even going to sit down and talk to you about this. They do have to sit down and talk to us, but they don't have to agree. So with that, I stop my conversation with you and am ready to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Representative Doherty. Any questions for the representative?
I have one.
Representative McLean.
As you know, this summer we had a task force on class size,
Yes. And there is a report that has been sent to everyone, and it talks about, it's an executive summary, and it talks about the importance of task size. And would you agree that this is a report that backs some of the comments that you're making on this issue?
Yes, I would. And this was last summer, that after the last session, that we pulled the group together. And they really did do, and they went through research, and they went through all of the things on class size. And it pretty much is reflective as to how class size does make a difference in the educational world.
Thank you. Paula?
And that is, what we can do is for those of you that don't have it right there, we can post it on OLIS. Mm-hmm. And so we will have the class size report on OLIS so everybody can look at it.
Thank you. Representative Solman has a question.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question in regards, I'm trying to figure out how to word that. So understanding that I understand the work of the task force, and I know as far as being in a classroom and being a school board member for 8 years, class size, and that is a major concern for a lot of folks that have children within the schools. I'm curious how we address the situation with funding, and you're looking at how, so I'm curious, I am interested in reading more about this and how this will work in, I can give you the example in Hillsboro. We've cut $70 million from our budget since 2008. So I worry and wonder how does this work into?
Well, what this is Vice Chair Wilson, Vice Chair Hernandez, and Representative Solman, is that, again, it's the idea there are a lot of districts that have lost a lot of money. Yeah. In fact, we actually lost more money than that in 2003 because we got no money for the last part of the school year in Hillsboro. But what it is it does not require you to change class size. It requires you to sit down and talk about it. And there are sometimes in collective bargaining that people have trade-offs. And what we're going to do is we want more in insurance than we want in salary. We want more in this and less in that. And so it's a trade-off. Or you may come up with the settlement that we're not going to talk about it. We're not going to deal with it. And so it's not something, and I want to make this very, very clear, because you have mandatory class size as a subject of bargaining does not mean it is going to be in the contract. It just means that management can't go through and say, we're not even going to talk about it. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vile.
I'm still curious, though, if management says, okay, we'll talk about it, and then they say, nah, that's not going to work, and from that point on, they don't want to talk about it. I just guess I'm trying to figure out what this is going to do for us.
Well, I tell you, when you start talking about this, and if you've been in any negotiation system, I am sure that with the Medford School District and the Central Point School District, they didn't start out with these numbers. They could have, but usually that's highly unlikely. So usually what you do in any sort of bargaining situation on something like this, you sit down, you talk, and you say, what are the concerns that you have? What can you not live with? What is going to be the cost? And we go through and we do all of this sort of thing. And at the end, if both sides are still talking and want to come to an agreement on this, then both sides come to an agreement saying, we can live with this and this and this, but we can't live with this, 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 because of whatever. And that's how you come up with an agreement.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
I've been on a school board. Mm-hmm. I've negotiated contracts both in the school environment and other places with unions. And it feels like everything's always on the table anyway. In other words, you're not going to ever say that's off the table unless it really is off the table if you're management. And what I'm trying to understand is if management has gotten to a point where they say this just isn't going to work, we've got to start somewhere else if we're going to get to an agreement, what does this do? It says, no, you have to actually say the words, and then from then on, you're okay?
Well, no, what it is what this means is you could have that conversation to get to that certain point in the conversation. Without having this as part of mandatory subject to bargaining, you're not even going to be discussing it, because management will have the right to say, this is not a permissive subject to bargaining. We don't have to talk to you. And so that is why it's so important to have these sort of things to start that discussion. When it comes to bargaining, and, you know, I've bargained dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of contracts, you don't bring out everything Right. Because there's a lot of stuff that's already in agreement, or it's not a problem, or it's something that you really don't not need to work on. And most people who are successful in bargaining go through and bring out what is of concern of the membership. Mm-hmm. And it's the same sort of thing with the board's team. What is concern of the board? And so when you go through and you go the back and forth, you go, oh, well, I see that that's what they're really concerned about, so we're going to deal with it. Or management, listen, oh, so that's what their real concern is. And that's what the negotiators come down with is that. And there are going to be times that you will not agree. And depending on what the issue is, either you go all the way into a strike or you don't agree. And I've said 9 times out of 10, almost 99.999% out of 10, you just don't agree, and you admit that we're going to agree to disagree, and then we go on. And that's usually what happens in public school bargaining.
One last follow-up, Vice Chair Wilson. So I'm the union rep. You're management. Mm-hmm. And I say we really want to talk about, as part of this new contract, class size. Mm-hmm. And you say, okay, what do you want? And we say, we want grades 4 and 5, no more than 25. And you say, nope, not going to do it.
Okay.
Have we satisfied the discussion now under your proposal?
Well, under this it has, but I think from a negotiation standpoint and from a labor relations standpoint, what I would do is, as you know, I mean, if management said no, I would say, what can you live with? Yeah. What are some of the things? And so what it is that the discussion doesn't just start with in a good labor relations school district or any sort of group. It's when you go through and keep talking and finding out what is and talking and talking, and once you get to a certain point, then you go, oh, we're not going to go to get an agreement on this, so let's move to something else. And I think the most important thing with this is actually it's the relationship that you have between the district and their bargaining units, and that is something that is very important, and this could possibly help that sort of relationship.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any additional? Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Representative Doherty, do you know, off the top, you know, what a collective bargaining process costs a district in terms of labor time and attorney time and all of that? And what do you think that does to the cost a school district incurs when we add more mandatory components into collective bargaining? How much more time that takes? How much more resource that's taking dollars out of the classroom to do that collective bargaining process?
Chairs and Representative Parrish, actually it depends on what the district is. It could add absolutely nothing to it. And the reason is that most management negotiators, I mean, we're working for what the people have paid their dues for. And so that's not an issue. But if you're looking at it from the school district management standpoint, a lot of it has to do with the direction of that the district has told what their paid negotiator is. I'm going to say paid because some are paid negotiators. So I've bargained contracts where it's been the superintendent or it's been a principal or it's been a school board member. And so it all depends on the parameters that the district has set. And on something like this, I can't see it adding a tremendous amount to the bargaining concepts, especially if you get to a certain point and you say it just doesn't look like we're going to be able to come to an agreement on this. And so I don't, to be honest with you, I don't know what management budgets for collective bargaining, but it can vary all across the board. I've had some negotiation sessions that have ended in 4 hours. And it was a very, very long, you know, contract. I've had some that have gone 4 months.
Follow up.
Thank you. The other question I would have, because I truly don't know, are things that are permissive on the table versus mandatory on the table, can you equally strike over the things that are not required bargaining, or can you only strike and call a teacher strike for things that are mandatory?
Chairs, Rep. Parrish, actually, if they are not a mandatory subject of bargaining, then it's not on the table because management doesn't have to talk about it.
But I guess the question is if it's not something management has to talk about, theoretically, if it's mandatory, that's another cause for strike because now it's a mandatory thing, and that puts potentially a cost into the system.
I didn't understand the question.
if it's not a mandatory bargaining item, then there's no cause of action for strike. But if it's mandatory, then it is a cause of action for strike, which could also theoretically put cost into the system.
Yes, but I think you also have to realize in the state of Oregon, unlike the state of Washington, we have the right to strike, as most public employees, not fire and police and corrections. And we have had probably 1/12 the number of strikes as the state of Washington, which is illegal to strike in Washington for public employees. And I think the reason is we've had a good relationship with the school districts and the school boards and the unions to go through, because labor relations is something that is so very important that both sides are willing to work together to do that. So that's been my experience.
Thank you. Representative McClain.
Thank you. This is kind of a convoluted question, but I think you'll understand it as somebody who's done this. Let's say, for example, like maybe 10 years ago, if in the bargaining, the management said, we're going to have to cut 15 teachers, but if you don't take, you know, a COLA or you don't take an increase, then those teachers don't have to be laid off.
Yep.
And so, you know, there was something that maybe they wanted both. They wanted the teachers to be retained, and they wanted, they wanted a raise in their salary, but they chose teacher be retained, no raise in salary.
Right.
Would that be the same possible thing? Do you want a raise in your salary, or do you want to have lower class size?
Mm-hmm.
Could that be negotiated?
Chairs and Rep. McClain, from my experience of 25 years of doing this, you're exactly right. It's one of these things that, I mean, I have never balanced my checkbook, but I can find $42 in a $42 million budget, school budget. And so we know exactly where the budgets are and where things are budgeted and how much is cash carryover and how much is in contingency and this kind of thing. And, you know, we don't want to go through and have the district not be able to pay for something, because when push comes to shove, it comes out of our children. And so that's where it is. And there have been a lot of times, and I think that recent times have shown, by and large, most teachers have not gotten a pay raise in probably 6 or 7 years. And the reason is that you may bargain a 2% increase, but then there's been 4 or 5 days of furlough days. And a furlough day is half a percent of salary. And so that's where we talk about, you know, when there's a furlough day, which luckily, knock on wood, there haven't been any in about the past 2 years, that's a decrease in salary. So there is that balance, and we don't go into it with the idea of, well, we're going to get all of this stuff, because there's a finite resource.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Solman.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I look forward to getting more information on this, and I'm just trying to wrap my head around the fact, when we think about the money that we are allocated and what we need to do as a school district to do with that money, usually your biggest impact is as Hillsborough, I think, is possibly looking at a $9.5 million shortfall. Your impact is days or people, because it's made up of 85% of your school district is people. And I worry, though, and I totally get this. I totally understand. But I worry that when you're in such a budget deficit time, how do you address this when your funds are not there to...
Okay, Vice Chairs and Representative Solman. First of all, this is not... The idea of a budget deficit is not a new concept.
Right.
I was laid off the first day I taught in 1974. Mm-hmm. Because we had no budget, because it had not been approved by the voters. And since that time, there has not, the stability in education funding has been shaky at best. And so, you know, to kind of answer your question, will you go through and you look at all of it? I mean, we dealt with this in Hillsborough. We had a 9%. All of a sudden, they said, you're not going to get any money in 2003, the last couple of months of, you know, where we get payments every 6 months from the state, and we faced tremendous shortfalls. Mm-hmm. And what eventually ended up, and we did not agree with this, but the district implemented, I think they closed 20 days.
Yeah.
And so those are the sort of things that we look at, and I think what you realize on something like this, with class size, for example, in my own school district, we have a local option, and that local option is used to lower class sizes.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have class sizes in the Tiger-Tualatin contract, but that is what the purpose of it is. And so many times with this, and with negotiations is also where the priorities of the parties are. Mm-hmm. And if the priority of the parties is to get our class sizes down low and so on, that's something that they'll work with. But no, we've been facing deficits for at least 15, 20 years. And things that we have to cut, and things we have to do, and we have, and it does deal with personnel, but it also sometimes deals with some other things too. So, but it's a real concern for, and a real worry standpoint for school boards. Absolutely, absolutely.
So. Any further for Representative Doherty? All right, seeing none. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We'll call up a panel of three, and Jared Mason Gear from OEA, Maureen Barnhart, former Hillsborough Education Association President, and Sarah Schmidt, Beaverton Education Association President. If you'd come forward, please, I'll let you decide who testifies first, and when you do, please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. Chair Wilson, members of the committee, Jared Mason here with the Oregon Education Association, representing 44,000 educators around the state who serve approximately 600,000 students in K through 12 and approximately 70,000 students in community colleges around the state of Oregon. Here today testifying in support of House Bill 2651. Thank you very much, Representative Doherty, for bringing this bill forward. From our vantage point, every 2 or 3 years, depending on the contract cycle, members of a bargaining unit and the district come together and they bargain things like pay, benefits, school days, and so forth. We think that one of the most important elements is missing currently, and that is class size. This bill really is about addressing what we think is missing from the collective bargaining statutes and really lifting up the ability of educators to advocate for students. It's, I think, very clear, and the members that are here today will testify in more detail to the effects that large class sizes in Oregon have on students and the ability to properly educate students and respond to each of their individual needs. And as class size in Oregon has increased over the years and Oregon continues to lead the nation in some of the worst or largest class sizes, this is becoming, in our opinion, increasingly vital that we address this matter. So this bill really is about adding voice and adding flexibility. You know, we have 235 bargaining units around the state, 235 contracts that are negotiated between bargaining units and local school districts. And each of those is different. They all prioritize different things. They all meet and hash out what are the best ways to deliver for this particular student body that we serve, these particular the particular community is going to have something different every time that are valued or different aspects of the contract that are going to be offset. And so salary schedule is very, school days vary. The class sizes really, we believe, are something that educators in the district should be able to sit down and hash out where that fits vis-a-vis the other elements of the contract. And so that's all we're asking for in this bill, is that this would be added as something that would be bargained, and then giving that voice to allow educators to do what they are called to do, which is to advocate for students. I think I'll, at this point, probably defer to the educators that have come down today, because they really do have the expertise around what kinds of impacts this has for them and the work that they've done, and they have expertise both as classroom teachers, but then also as folks who've been heavily engaged in bargaining processes and can speak a little bit more to the intricacies of the contract, and then happy to answer questions afterward. Thank you.
Thank you. If you'd identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Chairs. My name is Maureen Barnhart. I've been a member of the Hillsborough Education Association bargaining teams for several contracts since 1996 when we unified. I've taught in elementary grades, the alternative middle school program, and I'm currently a fourth grade teacher. When we survey the staff, the more significant concerns regarding our classroom and school environments, the issue of class size has increasingly shown itself to be a more urgent issue. They're the simple facts that you can figure out. It's harder to meet with kids when you have more kids. But there's also an impact on how we are trying to change our practices to better serve our students. Equal access for all of our students is an ongoing conversation in education. To ensure this right, the Hillsborough School District is working toward full inclusion. All students receive as much education as possible in the classroom where they can be part of a deeper conversation and discourse around a topic or concept. It's the right thing to do, but implementation is seriously hampered when the educator is placed in the position of working with large numbers of students. I think you already think of the kids on 504 plans or on individualized education plans, the talented and gifted kids. They all deserve to be continue to engage in learning, but we've learned a lot about differentiating curriculum. But now we've come to the realization that our students who have emotional and mental health needs, those who fall into the autism spectrum, those who suffer from adverse childhood experiences, are also entitled to a full education. Our counselors and other staff find themselves supporting those conversations to help us navigate and respect positive social interactions and maintain a safe environment. In these classrooms, it's easy for the children who are working on socialization to become victims or bullies of their peers. It's too easy for them to fall behind in learning. When we have students suffering from mental illness, it's imperative that we are helping them learn appropriate interactions. Their peers need to learn how to interact with these students and to learn what triggers the antisocial behaviors and how we can work together to avoid those situations. At the beginning of this school year, Hillsborough Superintendent Mike Scott told us that we were to make it a priority to develop positive relationships with our students. He told us that this goal is more significant than meeting all of the Common Core state standards. But in Hillsborough, we still set an average size for elementary and secondary, no matter what the mix of students is. So our students don't come in handy batches of 30 fourth graders, so you can just hire another fourth grade teacher. That's what our superintendent always reminds us of. But if we could have this legislation allowing us to have conversations about differentiating our class sizes, and direct our resources, that would help us provide that environment that our students need. Thank you.
Thank you. Could you identify yourself, please?
Good afternoon, Chair Wilson and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Schmidt, and I am a second grade teacher in the Beaverton School District. I've been on the Beaverton Education Association bargaining team for the last four contracts, and I currently serve as the BEA president. I'm a lot older than I look. In recent history, the contract negotiations between our school district and association have been quite collaborative. We use our own kind of hybrid of interest-based bargaining, and as an association, we see bargaining as our greatest opportunity to improve the working conditions of the educators in our district, and that directly affects the learning conditions for our students. We bargain a number of critical elements, compensation, workload, student safety, school safety. In Oregon, though, we currently do not bargain one of the arguably most important factors that affects our ability as educators to do the best for the students that we serve, and that's class size. I wanted to be a teacher all of my life. I used to try and teach my little sister how to read, and she was two, so it didn't go super well. But several years ago, I almost left the profession because I started to feel that I wasn't able to really make a difference in my students' lives. That year, I had 36 third graders in my class. I was working at a Title I school, and my students were absolutely darling. However, they had significant social, emotional, behavioral needs. Many of them were English language learners, and I had a lot of curriculum that I had to address with each of them. There were days in which I didn't have a chance to check in with each of my students, even for a quick conversation, let alone give them feedback on their writing or have them explain their math problem-solving strategy to me. I went home every night kicking myself for not giving each one of those kids more of my attention. In the years I've had smaller class sizes, I have felt much more able to meet the various and critical needs of all of my students. Our work is incredibly relationship-based, and if you have a large class size, it is incredibly difficult to build the relationships that you need with your students as well as their parents and families. Workers in collective bargaining agreements in virtually every other field, whether it's nursing, bus drivers, home caregivers, all include negotiations over their workload. We are asking that this be a part of the conversation for educators and students as well. This bill is very simple. It's about putting one of the most important factors in education front and center. It's about forcing educators and school districts to sit down at the bargaining table and figure out how to limit class size so the teachers can do what's right for all of their students. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for our panelists? Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So I kind of want to combine a little piece of what I heard Representative Solomon say and Representative McLean say. you know, if there's a bucket of money that the district is budgeting with, and that bucket's pretty shallow right now, and I heard Representative McLean sort of talk about, well, maybe we want to trade pay for class size. Is that a realistic thing? And I ask that because I remember when I was on this committee in 2012, and in Portland Public Schools, there were budget shortfall, and they were trying to figure out how to fill that out. And what was on the table was that there were folks who said, well, maybe the people at the highest tier of the step increase, if they could hold that off, they could help preserve class sizes. And then that didn't, you know, really happen. It was, we're going to riff 100 teachers, because there was another bucket of teachers who said, well, you know, who at the top end of the tier were not interested in doing that. So I have a hard time maybe believing that we'll trade pay for class size as part of a negotiation piece when the bucket's really limited. So can you kind of speak to that a little bit as a negotiator?
Go ahead. Thank you, Representative Parrish and Chairs. I'm in Hillsborough, and we have spent several years saying that we would rather keep program and keep class sizes and keep our newer members, and we have taken freezes for many more years than we expected to. But it was worth it to us to maintain a quality school district. So, yes.
Yeah, and I would add that I think Representative Doherty touched on this, that it at least allows us to have the conversation. And every time we sit at the bargaining table, we're dealing with a little bit of a different financial situation, and this at least gives us the ability to discuss it. And I think that, you know, school districts, parents, teachers, everyone agrees that a smaller class size is really ideal for all of our kids, so it'd be nice to be able to discuss it at the table.
All right, thank you, Representative Bile.
First, an apology to our Chair Doherty for my grilling a moment ago, because I had not yet read the specifics of the bill, and I'm going to confess that, but I have now. And it appears that the only thing that happened here is the words class size were taken out of the exclusion in the 243-657A definition, and then we got a special inclusion, employment relations includes class size insertion. I worry a bit about saying, okay, we're going to take it out of the exclusions. I get that. That makes a little more sense to me, although I suspect it was put there for a reason at some point in the past, probably because between management and the union there was discussion about whether that was really a condition of one's employment, like your pay or your hours, etc. I kind of understand that it would no longer need to be in the exclusions portion, but if we put it in the inclusions portion and not a whole bunch of other things that you may want to talk about, are we running the risk that someone then argues, well, gee, that didn't get put in the inclusions portion, we're not going to talk about that, or this didn't get put in, we're not going to talk about that? Does it really need to state specifically that it's now included if you've taken it out of the exclusions? Did anybody follow any of that?
I didn't.
Starting to look doubtful.
I'm dubious now.
Vice Chair Wilson, Representative Bile. I'll do my best. So if I understand the question correctly, I mean, I think I can answer it first with a short answer, yes, which is that we do believe that it is necessary. From our viewpoint, this really is one of the most vital aspects of the conversation that is being had. Is, I guess, another short answer to what I believe is another question that was embedded in the questions. No. No, being the answer to the question, does this preclude other aspects of the bargain from of the negotiation from occurring around other aspects of the contract? I'm fearing that my answer is about to become
as bad as my question.
Yeah. Getting there in my head.
This might be saved for the hallway, maybe.
I'm happy to follow up, but I think that and we feel very comfortable with the language in the bill, that it both appropriately elevates a conversation that we believe needs to be had without precluding other conversations that may be agreed upon or important or deemed to be important by both parties to the negotiation.
Thank you.
All right. Rep. McLean.
This is kind of a perception check, but I wrote down all of the things that you said that you believe that class size affects, and you believe it affects relationships, it affects absentee rates, it affects safety, it affects student achievement, it affects equity, it affects the teacher's ability to do a good job to individualize and get a relationship with all students in the classroom. If
and
it's
for
large.
The students to have a relationship with each other as well.
Okay. But, and so this is the question for anybody, and that is, so isn't that a condition of employment? If you want to do a good job as a teacher, don't you need, if you're going to be able to do all those things that you want to do and we want you to do, don't you need to have some kind of control over what size the class is? Isn't that why you want it?
So thank you, Representative McLean and Vice Chairs. Yes, and it's also because we want to be able to have, I feel very comfortable that in Hillsborough we look at the big picture of the district, and it's always changing who the students are, and this would just be one more opportunity to be able to say, here's where there's a problem. Maybe the answer here is that these class sizes need to be kept smaller or made bigger, I suppose.
Okay, now I apologize to the rest of the... you guys, I was in that classroom for 42 years, and there's no doubt it costs more money to buy more staff, but if you need more staff to do the things you all say you want, let's get higher, you know, graduation rates. Let's get that absentee rate down. Let's get relationships. Let's keep people safe. Let's deal with traumatized kids in their school that have come from situations with family. I'm passionate about this. So I love this panel.
I agree, too.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that. And to our panelists, thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Next up, I want to have Chuck Bennett come up. Chuck, I'm sorry we didn't communicate. I know you needed to be moving on for a meeting. Richard Donovan, if you would come up, too, at this time. Chuck, I know you got to run, so if you'd do the routine, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I'll be brief. There is no debate on class size, just none. Smaller classes is better for kids. It's better for teachers. The education is improved. I think all the conditions that change and be in the working experience of a teacher described by Representative McLean are true. I mean, that's not the, unfortunately, it's not the issue today. In fact, just to kind of add to the mix, we'd like to see social workers, psychologists, nurses, more teachers, education assistants. I represent principals. I'd like to see more assistant principals. I think that'd be tremendous to have more adult leadership in the schools, as well as counselors. We'd like more janitors, more secretaries, more bus drivers. I mean, I can just run down the list. The problem is the funding isn't there. The funding is just not there for the level of personnel that we believe would be called for by the quality education model. It's just not there. And appreciate the opportunity to discuss this and are not really in a position, I think, to debate whether this ought to be mandatory, permissive, prohibited in bargaining. Bargaining is bargaining. But presumably, when you go into bargaining, and if you're going to make it a mandatory subject of bargaining, using the chair's, I thought, really good description of it, there's trade-offs. Problem is, for management at this point, there's nothing to trade. The assumption is, if there's going to be trading, and in the case of personnel, the trading is often pay or benefits, about 85% of our budgets, we would have that available under the current funding size. We do not have that level of funding available to make this a fair trade. We would come to the table with our pockets empty, debating whether or not there ought to be more personnel we can't pay for, in a bargaining situation that's imbalanced at that point. So we would ask you, this may come up someday and be a really reasonable thing to be talking about, where we can actually talk about working conditions instead of education conditions. And that's what we'd like to talk to you about as time passes, is what's happening to the education of our children in a funding system that's absolutely inadequate. Mm-hmm. And this certainly is an important issue. This just may not be the session for it. The session will come when we can hit the quality education model and we're actually meeting the true needs of these kids, and when we can talk about how to rebalance a really full personnel cadre in the classroom and in the rest of the schools. And again, really appreciate the opportunity to talk about class size and these various issues. This is really important. This just isn't the session for it, and this may not be the decade. It certainly hasn't been in my experience over time as a lobbyist that we've hit the level of funding where this can really be seriously discussed. We're always pulling back, not pushing forward, and I admire the chair for taking us on some sort of forward mission, but I don't know. It just doesn't look good ahead unless we can start talking seriously about money. So thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, next up, Richard.
Mr. Vice Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Richard Donovan on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. I'm really encouraged by the testimony that's preceded me. We've had, OSBA, nobody in OSBA is going to be kind of the climate change denier in the room that's going to try and tell you the ice caps are fine. As it relates to class sizes are too big. And, you know, Representative McLean spoke to the report, the good work that the task force on class sizes just completed. And the work of that committee kind of approached it, their conclusions in two ways. One, they said that there was a tremendous amount of anecdotal evidence that said class sizes in Oregon were too large. And two, class sizes could only be remedied by adequate funding. The thing that I haven't heard yet in the testimony that preceded me today was anybody make a connection between class size, bargaining for class size, and reductions in class size. If we're trying to achieve outcomes like lower class size, I think the question needs to be asked, will bargaining achieve that? And I don't think that we expect it will. You know, I'm here as a representative of 197 school districts and 19 community colleges, and our expectation is that if we add this to the list of mandatory items of bargaining, we will have more bargaining. And we will have more instances where schools, due to circumstances that they cannot control, have to go back and be put into labor strife or labor disagreement. And we don't think that that's an outcome that really benefits children in any way. Representative McLean, you know, to your points about the connection between the work of teachers and kind of the committee's greater concern with whether or not this is a workplace condition, those are valid questions, but they're not questions that the school district is in any position to address, because we can't turn anyone away. If a kid shows up, they get access to schools and services, and that's just kind of the nature of things. Unlike our friends in post-secondary education, we can't raise tuition. We can't say, no, you can't have a seat. If you come to school, you have a right to attend, and those services have to be extended. I'm glad that Representative Doherty, you brought up 1991. In 1991, I was also 122 pounds. I was a very large 99-year-old, so I'm really glad that I could reminisce about that. And, you know, I would say that Supreme Court case, while 25 years old at this point, a lot of stuff has changed, but the logic in the Supreme Court case did not change. The Supreme Court case says the balancing test that's commonly employed in labor relations is the right method. The ERB just happened to consider the wrong circumstances. And so when you look at kind of the 25 years of case law in this area, it says there has to be a balance between teacher employment and management prerogative. And the end result is focused on what gets to students. And so that logic, I think, I'd really like to underscore for the committee that this isn't the kind of thing that is arbitrarily done. There is a balance. And what I've heard today from the actual negotiators in the room, I'm a lobbyist, not a negotiator, is that these conversations are happening already. Nobody has said, we want to talk about class size and we can't. Everybody who preceded me has come up and said, you know, we talk about class size all the time in our negotiations. we don't. this is a part of our conversation today. So, you know, I will kind of leave it that. I'd be happy to take any questions. I just, you know, want to reinforce that, that these considerations shouldn't, remedies for large class size should be remedies of funding and hiring more people. They shouldn't be remedies of changing labor law. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have more of a comment and then maybe a question in it. As somebody who's currently serving on a school board, and I've served on a negotiation team as well, when the negotiations are happening, whatever conversations take place really set the tone for the realities that these employees face. And my concern about not having that included in the conversation is that those of us who, whether we're representing the administration, don't get to hear the day-to-day reality on the ground from our teachers. And class sizes is a huge component to that. So, for me, it would set the tone for the continuation of a conversation in a way that shows empathy and understanding towards the employees in which we have in our school districts.
Representative, I think that's a very good point, is that this remain a topic of discussion. I have yet to talk to a school administrator anywhere in the state of Oregon. I've been talking to him for a long time who does not talk about class size. There is a common discussion going on in our public schools about the impact of class size in districts where class size is really an issue. It isn't in all of them. We certainly got a lot of small districts, probably half our districts, if not more, where this just isn't an issue. And in those larger districts, this is a common discussion, and I think it was certainly testified to that in districts where it becomes a really big issue, it is negotiated. And I think the examples that the chair gave were good examples where these became issues that had really boiled up, and they had the resources and a system in place to resolve them. I don't think these don't get talked about. I have yet to hear someone not talk about class size. If they do, the parents will remind them they don't like the fact that the classes, I'm sure you all get it at your school board meetings, nobody's going to be surprised that in some districts in this state, particularly our larger districts, class size is a very big issue with parents. And with administrators. And BAM.
Thank you. Just a reminder to the committee, we've got another bill to hear and we've got a bill to work, so we need to move along pretty quickly. Representative,
just a quick follow-up. It'll be a comment, but thank you for that response. If the conversations are already happening, then why oppose this change if these conversations are already happening?
It becomes a mandatory issue of bargaining, which takes it into an entirely different legalistic relationship between the bargainer and the person, the various bargainers involved, and changes really the stakes in the discussion. And I think you've heard from other members of the committee, as well as from my colleague, that it takes you into a different realm of discussion. It isn't just we're talking about class size or trying to figure out how to solve it. We're bargaining the issue, and we're doing, as the chair mentioned, trade-offs. Problem is, we don't have much to trade. Your board doesn't have much to trade for class size is part of the problem.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, I think the other thing that the committee hasn't addressed directly, but I think should be considered in terms of policies, is this really precipitates a lot of equity issues, especially for kids that have higher needs, one-to-one, two-to-one students. This idea of class size, which isn't defined in the bill, really does cause potential issues for schools that have no remedies when it comes to staffing for the traditionally underserved and kind of least served in historically.
Mr. Chair, I know we're short. I just have one question.
Rep. McLean.
To just that last comment, we're all on the same team. The superintendents, the school boards, and the teachers, the parents, we're all on the same team. We're there to help kids. But 100%. Two of the things that you said, so I'm just going to check on them. And the last one, Rich, that you just said, it's a negotiable item. Yes, it is on the mandatory list, but yes, the people who are negotiating get to talk about it. So it's not as if they have to have that class size changed or even the ratio changed because it's a negotiable item and they can have an impasse on it. So it hasn't actually changed it. It just makes it so that they have to talk about it. Now, I want to say just one thing, because you've been here a long time. You're new. And both of you have acted like the quality education model is superb. And I'm there with you. And I think some of us want to update it, and some of us want to do it, and some of us want to fund it. And you've just got done saying that if we fund the quality education model, then we're there. Well, I'm there with you on that. And I'll be there the whole way through, as long as I'm in this building. But what this bill does is it gives us another tool. And what it says is that it basically elevates the class size, and it elevates the respect to the instructors on the front line that are saying, we just want to talk about it because we think it's affecting students, student learning, and our ability to do our best job. Could you agree to that?
Well, I would agree with you that it's certainly one of the chief topics. We'd be glad to come in and talk with you about surveys we've done statewide where parents, kids, community members, as well as teachers and administrators and school board members will tell you class size is just a very big deal, mm-hmm. a very big deal. You have not funded that. We can talk about the quality education model, but as a legislature, as a state, we've not funded it, and so it becomes academic, I think. And I think that when you're going to take it in a time of scarce resources into bargaining, you're talking about a whole different dynamic. And you and I both know that. I mean, it will result in a different dynamic when I don't have the ability to meet your demand. You and I then look at other topics, and it does. It just changes. And I thought Representative Parrish pointed to it with a half or barely full bucket, and we come in with a bucket of demands. You've got a bucket of demands. I got a bucket of nothing. You know, that's my problem as the bargainer on the other side.
I will find it in the budget.
Would you find us a bucket?
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your testimony. Thanks so much. Last person signed up to testify on this bill, Tyler Shipman. Tyler?
Yeah. You can make it quick.
And Tyler, I'm sorry to put the squeeze on you here, but we've been verbose today.
Totally understand.
Thank you.
So, Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Tyler Shipman. I am a government relations specialist with the Oregon School Employees Association. We represent over 2,100 education employees across the state of Oregon. I'm here today to speak in support of House Bill 2651, and I'll try to be brief because I know you're on a time crunch. So House Bill 2651 would include class size in the definition of employment relations, making it a mandatory subject of bargaining. This would be extremely helpful not just to teachers but also classified staff. Our members include educational assistants and special education assistants whose effectiveness to support students and staff can be hindered by this class, oversized classes. Right now, our members are dealing with more students in the classrooms and less staff. In the period from 2006 to 2014, there was a 6% increase in the number of special education students in Oregon, and at that same time period, there was a 5% decrease in the number of full-time equivalent special education paraprofessionals. That leaves more students with less staff in our school. This legislation would be really beneficial for us, not because we want to control class sizes, but we want to ensure that class sizes are manageable and that when numbers are too high, it's harder for our members to provide a safe environment for staff and students and ensure that they're not getting hurt. The ability to bargain class size legislation could be used to address these issues that our members face on a daily basis. Right now, they're unable to do so. While class size is a permissive subject of bargaining right now, it has a profound impact on our members' working conditions. We believe strongly that class size should be a mandatory subject of bargaining, and as such, we hope that you'll support this legislation.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else here to testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2651.
Okay, thank you. May I? And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2688. Alethea, if you could read us the summary, please.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2688 establishes the Oregon Quality Education Model Modernization Task Force for the purpose of evaluating workforce requirements and opportunities for private sector investments in school districts and education service district regions. The task force sunsets on December 31st, 2018 and goes into effect upon passage and there's a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Evans.
Chair Doherty, members of House Committee on Education, thank you very much for listening to what I hope will be a brief presentation about House Bill 2688. For the record, I am Paul Evans. I represent House District 20, representing the communities of Monmouth and Independence, parts of West and South Salem. I had a few pages printed out to talk about this bill today, but I want to kind of skip to the basic points. First, there is an amendment that hopefully the committee analyst has now. We just literally received it midway through the committee meeting. But the amendment really just tries to clarify what I hope was in the first draft of the bill. But before I get to the specifics, as we sit here and talk about the issues involved in trying to put together the best education possible, I remember living in an Oregon and in an America where we did the right thing even when it was hard, sometimes especially because it was hard, when it was the right thing to do. And since 1990, it seems that those in power, Republicans and Democrats alike, and everybody involved has tried to do the very best we can to move the deck chairs around the luxury liner after it hit the iceberg, hoping that somehow a miracle will arrive. And my point is this. The bill that I've offered is designed specifically to recognize that the Oregon Quality Education Commission, which does great work, that's been in place for a number of years, is in many ways, I believe, encumbered by the idea of what the quality education model was in 1999 and 2001, which were good things then. But the world has changed. The world has changed significantly. I don't know, but I'm pretty certain that the Central School District didn't have 65% of its kids in 1991 on government-provided breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I'm pretty certain that school health care facilities weren't the place that most of my peers going through the Central School District got health care. I'm pretty certain that the focus of the Quality Education Commission, which is designed to adjust, update, make sure that the prototype schools, which you, if you haven't read, by the way, the 2016 Quality Education Model Executive Summary, page 49 through 55, does a great job of looking at the prototypes of class sizes. It does a great job of talking about number of school counselors, ratios, etc. What this bill hopefully will do is provide an emphasis for an expanded idea of what schools are for the 21st century, with an idea of making sure that every school district gets 100% of what the QEM model should be represented in the 21st century. And on top of that, not in spite of it, but on top of that, an additional 3% for local partnerships to ensure that the kids we teach can actually become employed within that area. Now, I have heard and I will continue to hear, and I'm pretty certain will be on all of our tombstones, the value and the requirements and the circumstances of our time that we live in budget challenged times. If you look at the quality education model, instead of $8 billion or $9 billion, we should be in the $10 to $11 billion this biennium, and that's not including some of the other aspects involved with health and special needs and other emergent challenges. My point is this. We are either going to continue to live within the artificial constraints that Measure 5, 47, 50, and our current hobbling tax structure has provided,
continuing to do the very best we can with the resources we have, knowing full well that we're not preparing the kids that we have a responsibility to provide the very best for, the tools necessary to succeed in the 21st century, or we're going to stop the insanity and say, you know what? We're going to actually explain what schools are to a generation of folks who don't know what schools are. See, here's the fundamental difference. 40 years ago, most people had a connection to the public schools. Nowadays, not so many do. There are adults that are paying taxes that do not understand the challenges in the current schools. I believe if we have an updated 21st century quality education model that emphasizes not just what we need, but with the 3%, the local tailoring to make sure communities can succeed with the assets and the priorities that they have, we can reinvest the folks that currently don't have a child or grandchild in the schools to recognize how schools are a cornerstone, not just for future education, but for democracy itself. I believe the quality education model is, in fact, the most important tool we could use, and I want to emphasize why. I'm a simple guy. Simple tools make sense to me. In the military, we didn't really spend a lot of time talking about curriculum, but we understood things like TO&Es, Table of Operations and Equipment. When I was responsible for putting together an assignment for an air tasking, looking at how we were going to put air cover to protect troops, I didn't talk about the various ways in which people could or couldn't engage their weapons. Rather, they handed me assets, they handed me parts of a fighter squadron, and I knew because what fighter squadrons had in terms of number of jets, number of pilots, number of equipment, number of mechanics, I knew based on that formula what I could actually achieve and what I couldn't achieve. I think if we use this right, the QEM can be a tool, a bridge to communicate to an entire generation of Oregonians that aren't as connected to the public schools what a public school means today. And I think that is a vital, critical element that has been missing in our conversations about revenues related to this building. I believe that most people, if they actually understood the challenges in the schools, would support it far more than we might anticipate. But that it is on each of us to make sure that people in communities that, again, are doing their very best to stay afloat in a very dynamic economic time, that they recognize and are invited into the schools and invited into the process so they actually understand what a school is today. That's why this bill is before you. There are a lot of good ideas out there to try to improve our school system. I hope to help play a role in moving some of those forward. But I ask us, please, even as the conversations over SBAC and No Child Left Behind and this or that curriculum program and this or that national initiative, we actually recognize that the systems and structures of what a school is, something that we sometimes just gloss over because we in this building have an idea of that, that we go back to the basics and try to re-educate the community about what schools are and why they're different now than they were 40, 50, even 20 years ago. I put trust in Oregonians to want to shoot for the stars. It's not their fault they don't understand what schools are and what they aren't anymore. And that's what this bill is about, and I ask for your consideration.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of Representative Evans? Representative Parrish?
So, in our Veterans Committee, we joke that Representative Evans is the representative from the task force district, so nice to see it carry over into House Education. Question for you, though, in all seriousness. Where would we be on the QEM, and maybe you don't know this, maybe we should ask LFO and some others, if we had found ways years ago to address healthcare cost increases that are going crazy on the staff side and the purse piece? Like, if those pieces were not where they are, would we be at the current funding level meeting the QEM for those two factors?
Chair Doherty, Representative Parrish. I absolutely think that that's a great question for the experts, but from my own experience in school board and my own experience in and around this building looking at issues over the last many years, I think we would still be a little bit behind. As long as Measure 5, 4750, the constraints on local government property tax continues to in many ways constrain what school boards and the discretion they have, I think that any conversation about what could have been is going to be a little bit hypothetical, because I don't know the opportunity cost of that $4 billion that's been pulled out of the property tax stream and its effects. So I would anticipate it would be less. I don't know how much.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you so very much. Anyone else want to speak on House Bill 2688? Okay, seeing none, we'll close the work session on 2688. And we're going to open, a public hearing, thank you, on 2688.
Somebody raise their hand.
Pardon? Oh. We will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2688. And if we could do it briefly, we still have two other items we have to go. Thank you.
Madam Chair, for your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the 44,000 members of the Oregon Education Association. Sorry for being slow on the uptake. And we just wanted to, on behalf of OEA, thank Representative Evans for introducing this bill. We've tracked the quality education model since it was first introduced by Representative Lynn Lundquist, then Speaker of the House, and have worked to help make it be not only how much, but how to deliver optimal educational practices in schools. Every 2 years, the council does do updating, but we think that with the Dash 1 amendments, this bill would be a great addition to the conversation about how to make sure that we reflect all of the ambitions of the state of Oregon. That's all I have to say.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, any other testimony? Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing again on 2688 and open up a work session on House Bill 2648. Alethea, if you could give us a summary. We talked about this last week.
Yes, yeah. Monday. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2648 adds school social workers to the list of professions that qualify this district or education service district to receive monies for decreasing the rates of absenteeism. The bill has no subsequent referrals, and the fiscal and revenue statement have been issued, and the bill has no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you.
Chair
Hernandez.
Thank you, Chair Doherty. Chair Doherty, I move that HB 2648 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Hernandez moves House Bill 2648 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Okay. Yes.
Thank
you, Madam Chair. I'm going to support this bill. It's a great thing. I think it's hard to say that it's not a good thing. But as you and I have talked about offline this session, I'm pretty reluctant to support very many education bills this session because we just keep adding and doing and changing and switching, and rarely do we hear new testimony, new information in testimony. This does not create a program change. This does not tweak a program. This just adds one highly qualified classification of a person that can fall in that and do the work that's already established. So certainly I'll support it. There are probably some really good ideas and bills I won't be supporting this session.
I hear you. Okay, thank you. Any other comments? Okay, if there's no more discussion, Matt, could you read the roll call, please?
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Yes. Representative Solman.
Aye.
Representative Springer.
Aye.
Representative Vial.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hernandez.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilson.
Aye.
Chair Doherty.
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes. And I will, we need a carrier for this. Representative Hernandez, would you like to carry this?
I sure will.
Be the social worker that you are.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, with that, I close the work session on House Bill 2648. And I open up a work session on
to introduce
a committee measure. So.
Chair Doherty.
Yep.
I move that.
Would you like to explain what it is?
Yeah, Chair Doherty, members of the committee, LC 2501 just directs the Department of Education to conduct a study on methods for improving and stabilizing school funding.
Okay. And then realize with anything that's introduced as a committee measure does not, and when it, if it goes forward, does not indicate that the committee agrees with it or anyone on the committee is obligated to vote for it or anything. It's just an introduction of a committee measure. Okay.
All right. With that, Chair Doherty, I move that LC 2501 dated 11-2-16 be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay. Okay, Representative Hernandez moves LC 2501, dated 11-2-16, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Representative Parrish.
So just do we know where the bill came from? With the drafter?
Speaker's office.
I think Speaker's office.
Speaker's office? Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Vile.
Madam Chair, I am honestly troubled by the concept of committee bills as it has evolved here. And I know I'm the newest among us and no doubt naive on this, but it does trouble me that we're going to put a committee bill out that doesn't have a name attached to it, doesn't have someone that's taking responsibility for it. So I'll be voting no on this.
But we did say it needs to come to the Speaker's office.
So does that mean that it is the Speaker's bill?
Usually, as many times with the committee bills, they are placeholder bills, especially at this session, this time of the session, placeholder bills. So if something comes up close to the deadline or whatever, then a bill will be able to be introduced. But you absolutely can be a clear conscience on this one. Okay.
Madam Chair, would you explain for the purpose of the new folks here what we mean by placeholder exactly?
Okay. What we mean by a placeholder bill is there's a lot of times there are ideas floating out there, but there's not necessarily an avenue for them in the sense of a relating clause. Relating clauses are new people. Relating clauses are very important. And so that's what it is. And so that's when you have relating clauses. For example, we had a bill once relating to PERS. And so that's pretty broad, and it's the same thing with this one, dealing with school funding.
No, so
that's what we do. But thank you very much. Okay.
Do you want to call the roll then?
Pardon?
Should we call the roll?
Yes, we can do that. So since is there any more discussion? Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to call the roll.
Given the next two meetings to make up for this.
Well, Matt, can you call the roll on this one, please?
Chase you to the hallmark.
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Solomon.
Aye.
Representative Springer.
Aye.
Representative Vile.
No.
Vice Chair Hernandez.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilson.
No.
Chair Doherty.
Aye. Okay, with that, the committee bill is
introduced.
Okay, that is it. I know you feel very badly. We will not see you till next Monday. Okay? Thank you very much for all your work this afternoon.
Wednesday. Oh, yeah.
That's
what we just
had. Okay, and with that, I close the hearing on committee bill. Close the hearing on committee meet.